Today, you've got another of these fantastic German war heroes for us. I believe it's Erich Hartmann today. Is that right?
Yes, it is. He's the most successful fighter pilot of all times, basically.
Well, yeah, but, I was just going to say, I think you wanted to mention something about Hans from last week as well, didn't you, just before we started?
Yes, there was the question on how he lost his leg exactly, and I was able to find that information, and I think it's worth mentioning. It was in February 1945, and he was attacking over a dozen Russian tanks, Stalin tanks and T-34 tanks. They were actually called Stalin tanks, this particular model. And they were protected by an insane amount of anti-aircraft artillery. And he destroyed four of them and then flew back to rearm and refuel, change his aircraft because it had been badly damaged in this first attack. And he reported to his superiors that the only reason that he is attacking the tanks is because they are only 50 miles away from Berlin. Otherwise, it would be inexcusable. It was that risky. I mean, he would take a lot of risk in almost any combat mission, but even for him, this was nearly inexcusable to attack with this tactical situation. And he would not allow the other Stuka pilots that were under his command to go in for the attack. They remained at a couple of thousand feet altitude. And he knew they didn't have the experience he had, or maybe the skill, but that's how he put it, didn't have the experience. And after destroying 12 of these tanks, there was only one Stalin tank left. It was smoking, but still operable. And he had only one shot left in his 37mm cannons because one of them had jammed. And then in his autobiography, he argues with himself whether it would make any sense to go in for another attack with just this one shot left. And in his imagination, this very tank rolling through Germany that made his decision. So he did attack, and his aim was true, and the Stalin tank blew up. But a few seconds later, he was hit by 40mm flak in the leg, and the left wing of his Stuka was burning. He felt that he was basically bleeding to death in his airplane, and he was going in and out of consciousness for several minutes while trying to reach the German lines. And he actually succeeded then in bringing down his Stuka in more or less one piece. And the next thing he remembered was waking up in the hospital on the table and realizing that his leg was gone.
Shocking. Shocking. I think I've seen some of the videos. Someone sent a video in of him when he was recovering, having lost that leg. And to then go out fighting again and still fighting in the war, I mean, that's real, real dedication for you. A real, real heroism. We really need more people like that around today that are prepared to take risks to save their people. But yeah, that's an interesting story. I'm glad you brought that up. And Dennis, have you got anything to say about that before it begins with Erich Hartmann?
Well, the only thing that this reminds me of is the Douglas Bader film. When as a kid, I saw the film, like it was like he lost both his legs and they made a big fuss about him going back up in the air again. So, you know, kudos to all the pilots. It must be an incredible job, really, and dangerous job to go up there and actually battle for your life. But certainly it's great to hear about these German heroes, because many, as one today, I had never heard of before, you know.
I mean, you think this was really, it was flying. It only just really started as well. It wasn't like, you know, they had an instruction book on what they were supposed to do. It was all just sort of learn as you go along. So it was real pioneers. Yeah. Pioneers.
Well, interestingly enough, like a little bit of research on Erich Hartmann, he used to say that he could always tell with a pilot. If the pilot was... the enemy pilot would start to fire without actually getting into range. he knew then that this was a pilot that he'd take down. But if a pilot waited and bided his time and was patient and was got close into a kill, or a kill range, then he knew he had his hands full. And I suppose it's only experience what tells you all this. And to try to learn experience in the air while you're fighting for your life, it must be incredible.
Yeah, they had no flight simulators. They had no 3D computerized flight simulators to learn on. It's all just learn as you go along. They didn't have small planes that they could learn on either. I mean, there really weren't really any commercial type planes. They were just the war planes. Just get out there and see what you can do. And when you come back, I suppose they would get debriefed and explain the strategies that they used. And through that, they would gradually get better and better and refine these strategies and be able to pass them on to the cadets. But these first ones that were fighting all the way back then, it was a real step into the wide blue yonder. And so it was you really didn't know what was going to happen when you were up there or whether you were going to come back. It must have been a real adrenaline-pumping experience for them. Really must have been.
Rush.
Yeah, really exciting.
Sure.
Addictive, I should imagine, as well. But, yeah, if you want to... Sorry, Dennis?
Yeah, it probably was, yeah. I mean, of course, we had the even worse jalopies in World War One. I mean,
yeah.
They used to them all over and all.
Tied up with bits of string, if you look at them.
Yeah.
Yeah. You think how could that have gone out there to fight a war? You know, it hardly looks like it's able to take off. But yeah, if you want to explain to us a bit about Eric Hartmann, then Schmidt, he sounds like another interesting character.
Oh yes, indeed he was. He was born in 1922 in Weissach, that is in southern Germany, and he actually spent some of his early years as a child in China because. His father was a doctor, and conditions in Germany were so bad economically that they actually moved to China to practice medicine there because a cousin of Hartmann's father was the consul in China, so he was able to arrange for that. And so he actually grew up partly in China and learned a bit of Chinese there. But then things in China went really bad because of the revolutions and the civil war type situation. Excuse me. And then the whole family moved back to Germany. And his mother actually had an interest in flying, just like her son. And she actually trained him in gliding, airplane gliding. And when the war broke out, he volunteered to become a fighter pilot. And he started his training in 1940 and completed it in 1942, which is quite a long time, especially comparing it to the later stages of the war when there was hardly any time to train pilots anymore. And from what I read, some of these later pilots only had 80 hours in an airplane before they actually went to war. So he was well trained, though. And there was actually an incident during his training where he showed off. He flew with his Messerschmitt over an airport or airfield rather, and he put it on the back. And flew about 30 feet above ground and performed several aerobatics. And for this, he was actually grounded for a week. And later, Hartmann actually said that this might have saved his life because someone else then flew the plane he had been flying, which he would have been flying if he hadn't been grounded. And that pilot actually sadly died in a crash.
So they did have, it shows you there that, how excited they were and how much adrenaline they must have had buzzing if they were doing, acrobatics like that. I don't know how, you know, when that first started, really, doing the aeronautic acrobatics. It's quite a skill. So he's lucky then that, that he didn't get shot down, but possibly he may not have got shot down anyway, because he may have been a better pilot than the one that did get that did unfortunately get hit. So when he started out, he was highly skilled.
I might have expressed myself wrong. This was not during the war. This was still during training, flight school, basically, where he performed these aerobatics.
Well, what happened to when it went out again the next time? Then there was just something wrong with the plane. Is that how the other guy ended up?
Yes. There seems to have been something wrong with the plane, and it crash landed unfortunately killed the pilot. So there was probably something wrong with the engine of the plane, and that is why Hartmann thought it might have actually saved his life that he was grounded for a week, because otherwise he would have been flying in that very airplane.
I didn't realize that the war hadn't started yet. I remember you saying the flight school, and I thought that was to do with that. And he was learning gliding before then. And I thought gliding is really important. If the if the engine's cut out, they've got to learn how to glide down to the ground, haven't they? Really, or do the best that they can to keep it gliding. From what I hear.
Yes, and the National Socialist government actually encouraged the formation of these gliding schools, because in the years after World War One, Germany was actually forbidden because of the Treaty of Versailles to have any air force at all, and
a
country needs to defend itself, so they would have to have an air force sooner or later.
Yeah, so, not a lot of idiot thought, but it was no air force, no navy, and a 100,000 army. That's all they could have. Can you believe that? Some idiot made them rules up.
Surrounded on all the sides by enemies as well, and not allowed to have any means of defending yourself.
Right. Exactly.
There are actually a lot of interesting subjects that we could go to maybe some other time. Probably. Very few people know that Poland actually attacked Germany in the interwar years, and actually attacked almost every neighbor Poland has, while we were being told that Poland was this peaceful nation that suddenly got assaulted by some insane German leader.
Yeah.
I had heard that.
The communists were filtering through Poland into Germany for the early fighting after World War One. Consequently, there's a bit of a history there.
I know that there's been trouble with Poland and other countries, and rivalry between Germany and Poland for quite some time. I did read that. But then I also read that, this was negative propaganda to try and excuse this. So, it's not something I know that much about. So it's interesting to hear that coming from you, Schmidt, not coming from the English language lessons from this, but coming from reading the German literature on it.
Yes, I could actually recommend a very good book. It is called The War That Had Many Fathers. Der Krieg der viele Väter hatte. And it's written by a German general, actually, but not a World War II general. He was born later. And Schulze Ronhoff, his name is. And he very much in detail describes everything that happened pre-World War One, then World War One, and the interwar years up until the start of World War II, what exactly happened there. And it's a fascinating read.
Yeah, he has a lecture on YouTube. I recommend people watch it. It is in German, but it has got subtitles. And he actually goes towards at the end of the war, when he found out information in his research, where they actually changed some of the speeches of Hitler in the school books and made Hitler out to be, changed his speeches, making him to be the aggressor. Can you believe? It's a fascinating lecture, so... And the book is now in English, I believe. So, yeah, great call that.
I think they changed things quite a bit, didn't they? They changed what he said to try and make him out to be the bad guy. I think that still goes on today. You've only got to change one or two words in a sentence to change the whole nuance of it. And especially if it's another language, you can say, oh, well, this is almost close enough to the definition of what he was saying. And it changes the whole meaning, turns something around completely. And they do it deliberately. You know they do it deliberately. I can think of one or two books. Yeah. I won't bring them up now. But yeah, please continue, Schmidt.
Yes, okay. So back to Erich Hartmann. So he was in 1942. He was going to the Soviet Union to the war, to the front. And there was another actually curious incident where he had to get to his base, and normally they would bring them in by transport planes. But as it happened, there was a need for four Stukas to be ferried over to that base. Not the planes he was used to, the Messerschmitts 109, but the Stukas. And what happened was that he thought he was familiar with the plane and started it up. And then suddenly, he started rolling, and then suddenly the brakes malfunctioned, and he actually crashed the Stuka into a hut. Well, not actually crashed. He actually drove through the hut, and, the guy inside barely managed to jump out, and the Stuka was basically destroyed, and he climbed out, and as he describes it himself, he was shamefaced, and his superiors came running up, and then actually the other three Stukas that had to be ferried and had already taken off, one of them returned with engine damage and crash landed, and that sort of saved the situation for him, because then everybody was looking that way, and he sort of escaped that. But just again, just like with Rudel, he didn't start out as the
number one ace.
Yeah, exactly. He had his difficulties, just like Rudel had, and. These difficulties continued to haunt him, actually. So he flew in by transport plane after all. And then he met his superior officers. He joined Jagdgeschwader 52. That's Air Wing 52, I believe, in English. And they told him what it was like at the Eastern Front, what he had to watch out for. And there's actually an interesting part where the officer that was responsible for him describes to him what the discipline is like in the air. Most people probably have the impression that the military discipline was very strict in National Socialist Germany, and that the subordinates wouldn't have dared to question any order given to them. But what this officer told him is that only aerial victories count out here, not rank or other trivia. On the ground, we have military discipline, but in the air, each element is always led by the pilot with the most aerial victories and the greatest combat skill and experience. This regulation applies to everyone, including me. If I fly with a sergeant who has more victories than I, then he leads the element. This eliminates all question between pilots as to who is to lead. There is never any dispute, because only victories count. So this is the type of meritocracy that they had there. You didn't even have to be an officer to be in charge there, as long as you were the best pilot.
That's the way all things should be, isn't it? That's what National Socialism was all about, I think, was promoting people to just purely on merit, no equality agenda like we have now. The whole of fascism was like that, wasn't it? Go on, Dennis.
Can I just say, Sven, like, you know, in this country, in, you know, the RAF, they have an element of upper class, kind of a snobbery type of thing. I'm just wondering what the situation was in Germany, Mr. Schmidt.
Yeah, well, as I said, even a sergeant, a simple soldier, basically could fly an airplane, while in the English-speaking world, I think you had to be an officer and had to go through military school. Mm-hmm. And there was certainly some kind of snobbery in the German military. There were a lot of noble by birth generals, which you can usually distinguish by their von in the name, the off. There was some conflict between the SA and the German military, because the Wehrmacht actually was they looked down on the SA, and that was probably that was part of the explanation why there was friction between the SA and the Wehrmacht. The SA was looked at as more like rowdies, peasants. And so there was some friction between the two groups.
No, I was just wondering what the class system was like, because over in this country, a lot of people say that there is no class system anymore. I believe that's far from the truth. I know I knew a lad at school who was quite good at cricket. He went for trials for the county, and he didn't exactly go off to a posh school. And one of the first questions they asked him was, "Oh, what does your father do?" Which is, you know, in my opinion, has nothing to do with ability at cricket, just like the ability of flying, which the Germans obviously saw and put first.
Well, as far as the official National Socialist policy, there can be little question as to what it was. There are several speeches by Adolf Hitler where he, in great detail, explains that all Germans should be brothers, there should be no distinction by class, and that they should all work together for the common good of the country. Of course, these speeches are never shown on the mainstream television shows, but you can find them on YouTube. They may get taken down now and again, but you can find them.
Well, believe it or not, Sony, we're going to bring out a CD set or a DVD set of Hitler speeches, but our friends put the block on that and they shelved it. That would have been interesting.
Yeah, that would have been interesting. A collection of all of them, especially with subtitles. That would have been fascinating. Sure. I'm not surprised they put a stop to that one.
No, not at all.
Well, what happened with the outbreak of the war then? What was his war record like then, Eric Hartmann?
Yeah, if I could just go back to the question about the class distinctions in Germany. There was actually the introduction of Reichsarbeitsdienst, that would be work service, and everybody had to complete a year working together, building roads, building dams and the like, and everybody had to do it, whether he was the son of a farmer or the son of a count or duke or whatever, or a rich banker. And the idea was to bring people together, so they know each other and know that they are not different classes that need to be at war with each other.
Well, what they do with that now, instead of having everybody do that, they try to bring it in that people that are unemployed or people that are disabled, they all have to go out on this work detail, and the work detail is the same as the punishment that they give to criminals, and the rest of the country or the people that do work, they don't have to go on any of this work details. So it's seen as a punishment. But if it was everybody and it was all for the good of the community, then that would be really good. And it would encourage people to look out for their nation and see the rest of their nation as their brothers. And it would level out the class distinctions. At the moment, it just gets used, that sort of thing just gets used as a punishment in Britain. I don't know whether they have the same elsewhere in Europe. I expect they do. It probably comes straight from the EU, this idea of using that sort of thing as a punishment rather than as an opportunity to bring the nation together for the good of the nation.
Okay, I'm sorry for going back to these things. I just realized time is flying, and we probably should get back to Erich Hartmann then. So his statistics. He flew 1,404 combat missions and shot down 352 enemy aircraft. 345 of those were Soviet aircraft and 7 U.S. American. And all of these American planes were P-51 Mustangs. Whoa. And back to his first experiences at the front line, he was flying with his instructor, and Rossmann, by the name of Rossmann, and they had reports of several Russian planes attacking German convoys. So they flew there, and then Hartmann just somehow snapped. He only had the one desire in his head, that was to score his first kill. So he did everything wrong that a pilot in this situation could. He raced ahead of his experienced instructor, went for these Soviet airplanes, and he shot at them and did not score a single hit. But instead, he was suddenly in front of them, and they were behind him because he had overtook them at great speed. And then he panicked and just he flew into the next clouds and then above the clouds, but he had no idea where his instructor was. And after he had calmed down somewhat, he actually was able to establish radio contact with his instructor, who told him to go down again beneath the clouds. And he did that, and then he saw an airplane approaching him about a kilometer away. So he panicked again. He went full throttle, very close to the ground, and he just couldn't shake that airplane. And this went on for a long time. He did hear the voice of his instructor again, but it was all garbled over the radio. He couldn't understand anything. And it then turned out, well, he learned that later. I should stick with the actual events. So he ran out of fuel. He was very far from his base. He couldn't make it back. So he crash landed his, belly landed his Messerschmitt. And fortunately, it was near a German convoy that took him back to the base. But then after he was back at the base, he actually learned that the airplane he was so afraid of was actually his instructor trying to rejoin with him.
Yeah, and
for that he was grounded 3 days. He had to work with the airplane mechanics and perform their duties instead of flying. And he was severely told off because, as I said, he had violated any rule that there is to air combat at the front line.
Gotta love these guys, don't you?
Yeah, just like Rudel, it didn't really click for him until somewhat later.
Yeah, but once it clicks, that's the problem then, isn't it? It does click, doesn't it? That is a problem with these guys.
Well, I suppose they work twice as hard at it if it's not quite working for them and they're not as good as the rest, and they're going to be working twice as hard at it, aren't they? Especially if they're determined. They're going to be determined to beat the rest, whereas the others might, okay, I'm okay at this, and they're not striving to actually get any better because they're as good as everyone else already. But then you've got someone who can't quite make the grade, where he works so hard at it, and he's determined to beat all the rest that he makes it to the top. I mean, that's a phenomenal record there. You know, 300 enemy aircraft taken down. That really is quite some record. It's quite a record to make it through alive after half a dozen missions as it is without taking out that amount of enemy planes. Please continue, Schmidt.
Yeah, this can probably never be beaten, this record, because of how the military aircraft have changed. I think it's inconceivable that in a modern war someone could shoot down 352 enemy aircraft. And he had a particular style of shooting down these enemy planes. A lot of German pilots were considered dogfighters. They would go into turning fights with the enemy planes, try to turn tighter and get behind the enemy plane and shoot it down. which was dangerous for several reasons. He would be under a lot of strain from the gravitational forces, which actually can cause blackouts in the sense that you start to lose your vision and get disorientated. But his approach was to first of all observe the situation, become situationally aware of the situation, and then pick out your target. And once you have done that, go in and only open fire at the very last second. He described it himself as he would only open fire when the enemy plane filled his windshield. That was very close, maybe 30 meters, even less in some instances. And that's how he was several times. He had to crash land or make an emergency landing because of the parts that were shot off from the enemy plane that damaged it, then his plane. So he only had a fraction of a second to actually shoot. But it ensured, first of all, that he actually hit his target. Second, that the enemy pilot could not evade the attack. He also would save a lot of ammunition, of course. He would, in later days, he would sometimes shoot down 11 enemy planes in one day. A lot of pilots would use up their ammunition and not hit a single target.
All these were hits, of course, because I heard that Gurin was getting skeptical of the figures coming back from the pilots in the east, and insisted on greater detail when a plane was shot down. He wanted ground information, information on the ground as well, to confirm them. And all these were confirmed on the ground, I believe. So, incredible record.
Yes, people actually got suspicious of, maybe even jealous of Hartmann in the ministry. And so there was actually people were sent to observe his air victories in airplanes flying with the formation, and it was confirmed that he did shoot down as many as were claimed. And anyway, under normal circumstances, it was necessary for another pilot to witness the air victory and then report it. So you couldn't just claim you shot down these planes. It had to be confirmed.
That's right, yeah.
It's amazing. A bit different to what they have today, these remote control drones, with someone sat there, you know, playing on a computer. Yeah. I think the risks that these guys were taking and the skill involved, just that fraction of a second is the only time he's got in which to fire. It's quite incredible, really. And to think he survived all this as well. What happened to him then near the end of the war, do you know?
Yes. So towards the end of the war, the Russians were, or I should actually say the Soviets, because Russia was not really led by Russians, as we know. He was ordered to surrender to the British. But that would have meant to leave his squadron, which included the mechanics on the ground, all the support personnel and so on, to fall into Russian hands, most likely. And so this is actually the only time he ever, denied an order? He did not follow the order.
Disobeyed orders, yeah.
Disobeyed the order, exactly, yes. And instead he stayed with his squadron, with all the people involved. And he actually then managed leading his people to surrender to the Americans. But what they did was hand them over to the Soviets, to the Red Army.
That was a surprise.
And then things turned really horrible, because he had to witness how there were several hundred German civilians there also. And there were horrible rapes of these civilian girls and women by the Soviet soldiers, and he saw all that.
Shocking.
hidden history.
Yeah. And he was then in captivity in Russia for almost 10 years, because he wouldn't break. They tried to turn him into a spy for them. They actually threatened him with sending agents over to Germany and killing his wife and family. But he wouldn't. He just refused to cooperate with them. And he actually refused to work for them, which I think takes an incredible amount of courage if you are in a Soviet gulag and just refuse to work. He went on a hunger strike, but they force-fed him after a few days. And he was sort of the leader of the German prisoners there. And when they put him into solitary confinement, they actually rioted on his behalf and freed him. And there was another interesting incident. At some time during the captivity, he was in several gulags, but that particular prison camp was in the Ukraine. And Ukrainians would come up and to the fence and try to give food to the Germans and try to convince the Soviet soldiers that they shouldn't treat them so harshly. This was because they had been treated well by the Germans and had good memories of them.
Which throws in the face all the propaganda of saying that the Germans turned on the Ukrainians when they're in retreat, which I never believe for one minute.
You can just imagine the horrific tortures that they would have put him under, and it's threatening to kill your family. That's what they did to the other Germans as well, isn't it? That's how they got that confession. The Auschwitz confession was threatening to kill the guy's family. So you can just imagine what he went through. I should imagine seeing the German women rape was a part of it as well. I should imagine that was designed to demoralize him. That's why he saw it. Again, that was a part of the torture. I'm amazed that he actually lived all the way through and refused to cooperate with them as well. That's just amazing.
1955, I think. I think he came home in 1955. 10 years, I think.
Yes, he was one of the last Germans to come back from Soviet Russia.
Because he didn't work for him, that's why they punished him.
Exactly. And actually, he was sentenced by a Soviet court for war crimes with completely made-up charges. They said he had deliberately killed 700 Russian civilians. He had destroyed a bread factory and so on. And actually in the 90s, I believe it was 97, when Russia was more or less itself again, a Russian court actually overturned that decision and declared it void and null because it was... I don't remember the exact phrase that they used, but basically it was not justice being done. It was a mock court and mock justice.
So they cleared his name.
So he was rehabilitated even by the Russians.
That's really good. I'm glad that his name was rehabilitated and his name was cleared. And that's amazing, really, to think that he survived all that time, refused to work with them. Even made up crimes against him, and yet he lived all the way through. What was his health like when he finally was released? And how was he? Was he still his normal self? Do you know?
Well, amazingly, he didn't seem to have suffered any visible damage. I think he was much more thin later on from pictures I've seen, but he actually joined the Luftwaffe of occupied Germany then in 1960, perhaps around that time. But he got in trouble there because he spoke out against the purchase of the US American made F-104 Starfighter because he considered it a very unsafe and bad aeroplane. But because of this opposition, he was actually he had to leave the new Luftwaffe. But it turned out he was completely right, because Over 100 German pilots died because of that airplane, because of air crashes, engine failures, and so on.
They really should have listened to him then. Listened to his authority. You would have, you know, you would have really would have thought they would have listened to someone like that with a record like that, who had been through what he had, with the knowledge that he had. You would think they would listen to every word that he had to say, not sack him for saying it.
My suspicion is, I cannot prove this, but my suspicion is that the German superiors of him were ordered to purchase that plane because it was good for the American military complex, industrial military complex. And yeah, and so, yeah, he just opposed it because of his conscience. He knew it was a bad plane and would only cause problems for the pilots.
So he could see they were being encouraged to buy junk then. That they were under the thumb of the Americans and having to buy junk off them so they wouldn't have a decent air force. And he could see that.
Yeah, I suspect that very much.
So that means the ones that were there in the air force were all ones that would put up with it.
Yeah, I think we should mention that he got married before he went to Russia to combat. And his wife actually stayed faithful and never gave up hope all these 10 years that she couldn't be in contact with him. And they sort of lived happily ever after, in fact. They had a son.
Sorry, I was just going to say, it must have been difficult for them soldiers. They were the wives back home and gave up on them and got divorced. And that must have been crushing when you're stuck in a gulag all them miles away.
Especially if you couldn't contact your home. You know, was he able to have contact with his home while he was in the gulag, or did they just not allow any contact and nobody knew whether he was alive or dead?
This is actually a question I cannot answer currently. I know that he wrote letters to his wife, but I'm not sure whether they actually allowed these letters to get home or not. But what is clear is that he was not allowed to receive letters back.
Right. I say one of the most moving parts from Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, is when you see some of these Germans returning home and you see their wives and the emotion on their faces. It's a really moving part of the film. It's very emotional.
That particular part, I mean, somewhere in the middle of the documentary, I mentioned that something like 3.5 million German prisoners and more or less the same amount of Axis prisoners were captured by the Russians. So that's nearly 7 million. Some were put into slavery and was in gulags. And the amount what came home was around 6,000. It was a real proper Holocaust. And even on the way home, when some of these prisoners were put on the trains going back to Germany, apparently the train would be stopped at some point and some of the Germans would actually kill some of the other Germans who had actually been lackeys to the Soviets back in the camps and had it quite easy. And they were simply murdered and just dumped, left at the station, the train would carry on.
So they were double agents. So they were like KGB agents, Germans, that had been put in among the Germans in the camps.
I'm not so sure. I think some Germans would have got an easier time if they'd have, turned back to communism and all this kind of carry on, or turned to communism and just embraced the old officialdom at the camp. Whereas the Germans, didn't and stuck rigidly to what they did, and a lot died, but those what didn't remembered the ones that had done them while they were all put on a train and sent back to Germany. They did kill some of these soldiers.
Imagine the shock they must have had. You know, what they remember was National Socialist Germany, but they remember Germany under Adolf Hitler. And 10 years later, they get freed, and then just look at what they come back to. Look at worse than Weimar before Adolf Hitler. And the relief of seeing your family again and being freed, and then just imagine the disappointment of seeing what had been done to the country and the way that people then thought after all the brainwashing especially the brainwashing of the young people. You know, sure. These are some horrific things to happen to some of the most amazing people, really.
Must have took some great strength to get through that kind of torture and work ethic of, because most Germans were worked to death. Must have took some doing to get through that and return home at least sane. Sure.
So you were saying 6 to 7 million of them were taken away and only 6,000 came back. That's only 1% of all the prisoners that were taken that actually returned. Just 1%.
So there's some mass killing going on somewhere in there. Got to be.
Well, yeah, and it wasn't the Germans, was it? This is just it. All these accusations of war crimes that come from the war criminals themselves. That picture,
yeah,
it says that the Jew screams as he stabs you in the back. Right, that's very true. Well, you know, that picture or that old saying, I mean, it's a Russian saying, I think, that one says that, and it's very true. And they do, they have projected their crimes onto their victims and then accused their victims of carrying them out. So did he live to a ripe old age then? I mean, how old did he live to, Schmidt?
He died in 1993, so that would make him something like 70. He was born in 1922, 93, so yeah, 71.
So after all that mistreatment in the camps, 10 years of mistreatment in the camps, and he only lived to 70. And yet here we've got these holo-hoaxers that claim that they survived the Holocaust, and yet they live on into their 90s. I think that's just proof itself that the holo-hoax is a scam.
No comment.
Actually, Hartmann, in later days after he left the occupied Germany Luftwaffe, he flew with Adolf Galland, which also features in Dennis's documentary. He's the one that says that Hitler never wanted war with England and would like to make peace with them because he felt that the British people were so similar to the German people.
What's that? Yeah.